Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a very special guest. He's an international bestseller. His name is John Verdon, and his new book is called Shut Your Eyes Tight. And what a great title this is. It's the second in the Dave Gurney series. Hello.
Hello, David.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
You are quite a good author. You have some really, really wonderful talent. You really do.
You're very kind, thank you.
I'm in awe of your talent to tell a story. You're really good at telling a story. And your books, the first thing that amazes me about this book is how heavy it is. Oh my gosh. I was amazed when I first picked it up. I'm like, this is really a heavy book, and the paper must be heavy paper. Is that intentionally done?
Well, I think, part of it is that it's over 500 pages, which,
right.
creates a certain bulk to begin with. But you know something about that I was a little afraid about the length of the book, because it's at least 100 pages longer than the first book. But the people who have read it somehow don't seem to notice how long it is. I mean, when they pick it up like you did, they may notice it weighs a lot, but it seems to move quickly, which I'm happy about.
It does, it does. It makes me wonder what's in your mind, quite frankly. It's to start out with a decapitation. A woman is just getting married and she gets decapitated. That's the beginning. Now, it sounds like the beginning of a really bad horror movie, but...
As a matter of fact, when my agent read it, one of her first comments to me after reading it was, "John, I'm getting a little bit afraid of you."
Does that bother you that people might be afraid of you?
No, I think that by the time people get to the end of the book, they understand what it's all about.
Right. Now, your picture, a lot of times with people that write, and I don't know if we would call this, I don't know whether I should even label what this book is. I might give something away. Let's just leave it a thriller. But I look at your picture, and you don't have a very menacing look on your book, so it's not like people are going to be afraid of you by looking at your picture.
Well, I'm glad I don't look menacing.
You look like a lawyer, to be quite honest.
Yeah, well, I was actually in the advertising business most of my life.
Right. But you're a much better writer than James Patterson. Don't tell him I said that, though.
I won't say a word. This is all secret, right?
Right, exactly. We won't say a word to him. I hope he doesn't even hear this. But
okay.
But you're a much better writer, and I think you know that, too. So, James Patterson, I do read James Patterson, and that may surprise you. But I also can see his ability to tell a story, too, but I'm just not as interested in his as in your characters. You have this way of really, really bringing out the characters, really bringing them to life.
Well, thank you. I was going to say it's sort of a matter of taste, what kind of books people like, but I think it's more complicated than that. I mean, when I read someone or I read someone extensively, the reason is because I'm comfortable with the voice I'm hearing in the book, and I'm comfortable with the central character. It's somebody who I don't mind spending time with. And I think, different authors create characters that, have different audiences because they're the kind of people they like to be with.
Now, I should mention that Crown Publishers was kind enough to provide me with a book to read. And let me tell you, some nights where I was up very late reading this book, and you got to be really careful about that, reading this book late at night, because I guarantee you're not going to be able to shut it. It really is that good. And what makes it even better is the fact that the chapters, like the prologue is called The Perfect Solution, and every chapter is named. Life in the Country is the first chapter. And I really like that you did that. What made you decide to do that? A lot of authors don't do that.
To name the chapters?
Yeah.
I don't know. It seems to me to be a comfortable way of doing it. It's just, I think it's just the way my mind works. I see it that way.
Right. That's one of the things I liked about the Harry Potter books. The chapters always had these little pictures at the beginning of the chapter, so you got a preview of what was going to happen in the chapter.
Maybe that's it, and I don't mean specifically the Harry Potter books, but I remember when I was a kid and my father would read stories to me. A lot of the things had that kind of an opening. It's sort of like you knew what was supposed to be happening in that chapter, and at least for me, it was a comfortable way of reading.
Right, exactly. Absolutely. And of course, I grew up with Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys. Yes, I did read Nancy Drew. I hate to admit that to some people.
Well,
but,
you know, I don't know if you ever read the Rover Boys.
No.
But actually, I think the Nancy Drew stuff, the Hardy Boys, the Rover Boys, if I'm not mistaken, they were all written by the same guy.
Right.
Who then, you know, kind of farmed out some of the detail work to people, but it was all one central authorship, really.
Yeah, today you never really know. I hate to say it, but sometimes you don't even know who's writing the book. I mean, Margaret Truman has a new book out, but Margaret Truman just died. So, I mean, right away you think, well, who wrote this book? Did she write the book 5 years before she died?
Right.
And, you know, you really don't know. I mean, there's all kinds of rumors swirling around about who wrote her book. Do I know what's true? No. I only know what the rumors that I hear, and why I hear them, why people spread these rumors, I have no idea.
Well, you know, I think sometimes that a writer becomes a brand, and it becomes a valuable brand, and maybe then there's a temptation to write a bit more book, write more stuff under that brand than one guy could really do.
Right. I really have this desire to ask you where you came from all of a sudden. I mean, you're such a good, great writer. I wonder why you haven't been around for 20, 30 years.
That's another very kind question. But, I wanted to be a writer when I was a kid. I had an English teacher when I was in high school who, after some writing assignment we had, he came over to me after class and he said, you know, John, he said, you really ought to consider being a writer. And I thought, oh, that's great, you know, I'm a writer. Wow, you know, now I know what to do with my life, kind of. Except I had no idea how to make money as a writer. And when I got out of college and I guess I was 21, I was getting married, and the only way I could find to write and make enough money to live at the time was in advertising. So I went into the advertising business, and, you know, one thing led to another, and I stayed in that business for 33 years. And
did you ever know James Patterson when you were in the advertising business?
No, he was at a different agency.
Right.
And,
I know he had his own agency at one point.
Yeah, I think he was CEO of maybe J. Walter Thompson or something. I'm not sure what agency.
Yeah, that sounds right, yeah.
But he did very well in that business.
And the interesting thing is some of his co-writers now have connections to the advertising agency, which I find a little bit weird. But
yeah, well, maybe that's how he knows some of them, or maybe it gives him faith in them. When I retired from the advertising business, about 14, 15 years ago, and as a matter of fact, the next thing I did, when I didn't jump into writing, I started designing and building furniture, and in fact, built all the furniture for my house and some of the furniture for my children's homes and that kind of thing. And finally, I don't know when it was, probably about four years ago, I think, my wife said to me, you know, you always kind of wanted to write. Why don't you take the time to do it? And I'd never, you know, completed any kind of fiction or anything. I mean,
So it was all a question whether you felt you could do it.
Yeah, it was kind of her prompting. And at the time, when I was reading a lot of detective fiction. I'd read all of Ross McDonald and Raymond Chandler, and I loved that stuff. And a British writer who I particularly love was this guy Reginald Hill.
You know what? It's funny you should mention. I just got his new book in the mail yesterday. Isn't that strange?
Which book is that?
It's called The Woodcutter.
Ah, okay. I think Reginald is a phenomenon. I mean, he's such an elegant writer. I don't think the guy's ever written a bad sentence.
Hmm.
And he's enormously prolific. I mean, there's like, I think, 22, maybe 23 books in
right.
Just that Pascoe DL series.
And what really surprises you, a lot of times they're more successful overseas than they are here in the United States.
Yes. I mean, I don't think Reginald Hill is a big deal here.
Right.
I mean, he certainly isn't, you know, a Michael Connelly or anything like that here. But I think he's a wonderful writer.
Hmm.
But anyway, after reading this stuff, it kind of dawned on me, number one, that I liked the genre, and number two, I started to get the feeling that I understood how it was done. You know, I kind of figured, hey, wait a minute, I know what these guys are doing. I know how they're putting these things together. So when my wife suggested I take a shot at doing something, that's when I started writing Think of a Number.
Which is a classic, and it's an absolute classic. If you haven't read it, you need to go out and get it. It's my pick for the summer at the store that I work at, and it's just phenomenal.
Well, it's geez, I thank you again.
It's one of the easiest books in the world to sell because it's so fascinating. I mean, the relationship alone between Dave and his wife, Madeline. And now, I'm wondering, is Madeline anything like your wife?
There's a similarity between my wife and myself and Dave and Madeline. There's a similarity in the relationship in that my wife, like Madeline, is a much more immediate person. She's much more involved in the moment, you know. If I were to go out on the hill in back of our house here and I were to see, you know, some flower I had never seen before growing there, you know, I'd be wondering how the hell it got there and, you know, why is it here and how is it growing here and so forth. My wife would just be looking at it thinking it was a beautiful shade of blue.
Right.
You know, I mean, she tends to have that Madeline quality of the here and now.
And here's the point, too, that I told this to somebody who came in the store the other day. Madeline is as interesting in this book as Dave is.
Yes.
And that's very unusual in what we might call this a detective novel. Though I guess he's a retired detective, but he's still a detective, really.
Yes.
But the fact that they're both interesting characters. I mean, I'm as much interested in what she makes her tick as I am what makes him tick. Sometimes I think even more so because she's so moody.
Well, you know, there's an interesting thing about that, and that is that the people who I've met over the past year who really, really like Think of a Number a lot also really, really like Madeline a lot.
Right.
You know, I think maybe that's sort of the key to what makes the book as appealing to some people as it is. I mean,
and then all of a sudden she'll come out and say something that's really from her heart. You know she really means it, and you know she's angry too. And it's wonderful.
Well, thank you.
She gets these wonderful one-liners and then takes off. her car goes down the driveway, and there she's gone. You know. But in her wake, you know, it's still that anger that's left in her wake. I mean, it's like she's made her mark, she's made her point, and you're going to listen to it, and then I can just take off, and then you're going to have to think about it for a while.
Yeah, because I have things to do.
Right. Yeah. I mean, she's wonderful. I mean, I can't wait to see what's going to happen in the third book.
Okay.
I mean, I don't want to give anything away about what happens in the second book, because this is, to give away this book would be a major crime. Absolutely. How did Lisa Scottolini get involved with your book? She's a big fan of your book.
Yeah, I think my agent knows Lisa, and I'm trying to remember whether or not my agent Molly Friedrich might also handle.
She's a major agent.
That was a very fortunate thing.
But this was an international bestseller. Now, how many countries are we talking about, and how successful was it?
Well, it's been translated now, or sold. The translation, or a couple of countries that we have sold it to, are just publishing it now, a year later. But it was sold in 27 different languages, which would amount to, I'm not quite sure how many countries. For example, the Spanish edition is being sold probably in about 8 countries. It's being sold through South America and so forth. Now, in terms of that bestseller thing, the hugest one per capita has turned out to be Spain itself. Apparently, I was talking to a Spanish newspaper reporter a couple weeks ago who told me that Think of a Number was the best-selling book in Spain last year. So
even more so than Camilla Läckberg. I know she's huge over there, too.
Well,
I don't know.
I do know that it was on the best-seller lists over there for at least 7 or 8 months.
And if you've never read her, you need to go out and get The Ice Princess.
Well, I will.
tell me that series doesn't. It's like eating. It's worse than eating peanuts. Reading her series, you cannot. You literally cannot get enough of her books. Right now, thinking about not having number 6, which is all over Europe but not in the United States, makes me want to cry.
Well, I love to get pulled into stuff like that. I love to discover a writer who, you know, I can't wait for the next book.
But you're in that league now, too. I mean, you've joined the league of her and many others who I feel the same way. Elizabeth George is another one I feel the same way about. you know, and I've not read Reginald Hill, but I certainly want to now. But
yeah,
but you have some really major talent. I mean, I can only imagine if there were three more in this series, how thrilling it would be.
Well, I'm not sure how many it's going to be altogether. I'm about halfway through the third book now. I'm supposed to deliver the manuscript for...
Oh, now you're going to tease me and say you've got part of the next book and I can't read it.
But the third book's coming along nicely, and when I was speaking to the folks at Random House a little while ago, and they said it would be really nice if I did two more after the third. So,
are you willing?
I think so. I mean, you know...
But here's the problem. You can't just let this go. I mean, this is a series you've got to have an ending to it. I mean, we've got to know, you know, more. I want to know more about Dave, and I want to know more about his wife. I want to know things that have happened to them, why they're like the way they are. I mean, we're going to find that out in 3, 4, and 5?
We're going to find out in 3, 4, and 5, and in 3, we're going to find out a little bit more about Dave's, son, who's been off on the periphery of his life for quite a while. Dave has his son, Kyle.
Right, absolutely, yes.
Who's going to be a bit more of a presence in the third.
There really is some strain there between him, Dave, and the son, and that's another thing that we feel while we're reading the book. That's whatever has strained their relationship. And
yeah, well, I think in a way it's strained by a number of things. I think one of the things that it's strained by is that maybe he and the son are a bit alike, and neither one of them is really terrific at relationships, and maybe they're both a little too abstract and a little bit too distant and a little bit too wary of each other. But we're gonna get into some of that in the third book.
Another thing I really liked about your book is I only found one tiny word that was missing from the manuscript. And usually I can find 4 or 5. Sometimes lately, for some reason, the editing has been poor in books. But yours is very well edited. I think there's one word that should have been inserted at one point. Where it was, I can't remember. But that was the only thing I found wrong with it.
Well, that's terrific. Good.
And it's so easy. I mean, I admit it's I just read a book. I won't say what book it is because I don't want to spoil it for anybody. Where a word was could have been a completely. It should have been been, b e e n instead of being, and it really bothers me when I see that.
Well, you know, I've noticed that too. Maybe I'm just getting old and cranky, but I've noticed that over the years too. That there are, and again, I won't mention the publications, but there are some publications that it seems to me that, you know, 30 years ago they were faultless, and now they're not quite faultless.
And the interesting thing is, everybody that's read Think of a Number thinks that Shut Your Eyes Tight is an even better book.
Have you heard that?
Because yes,
I have too, and that really encourages me because, you know, if you write one book and, you know, you hear stories about a lot of people who wrote a pretty good first book and then it kind of all fell apart. So I know that was a kind of an anxiety in the back of my mind when I was working on the second book.
And it's a very interesting cover. I mean, with obviously the blood there and the branch, and, you know, it's extremely. It's an eye-catching cover.
Yeah, I like it too. I really do.
I can't quite figure out what the red. They look like leaves, but they're all red. So
if you may recall, there's a reference in the book to rose bushes and so I think the designer was thinking in terms of something that looked a bit like a drop of blood and something a bit like a rose petal.
So how does it feel when you Think of a Number comes out and you become an international bestseller, you suddenly realize that this really is something that I can do and do well? What is that feeling like?
Oh, goodness. First of all, I'm a little more sure now after the second book that it's something that I can do. After the first book, you know, it was like, well, maybe it's something that I was able to do once.
Right.
But at least now I'm thinking it's something that I can do. And then, you know, maybe the second thought was, you know, it would have been nice if I started doing this, you know, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not exactly a kid anymore, see.
I wonder 30 years ago how it would have sold, whether it would have sold just as well. Because a lot of times the sales of a book depends on when it comes out, too. I mean, it's very much a timely thing. I'm not sure 30 years ago, I think that might still have worked.
I really don't know. But, you know, I mean, when you come right down to it, you know, what is, and so here I am, you know, at the age of 69, starting what amounts to a new career, which is fine with me. And in a way, I guess part of me is glad that it happened now rather than when I was a lot younger, simply from the point of view of perspective. You know, I think maybe if this happened when I was 25, I think I might have gotten a little too carried away by it.
Right.
And, you know, somebody asked me whether or not any of this had changed our life any. Well, you know, it changes what I do at my computer each day, but it hasn't changed our life any. You know, we live in a place not unlike the place described in, you know, in the books for Dave and Madeline. You know, we live on a nice house in a country place with, you know, 95 acres of woods and meadows around it.
Oh, do you really? Do you actually live in a really nice area?
Well, we live, you know, some people...
I don't even know what state you're in.
Oh, we're not all that far from where Dave and Madeline are.
Oh.
But, you know, we're very happy here. We're very happy with our lives the way they are.
But I don't want you to name any numbers or anything, but you're much, I mean, you're financially secure now, I'm sure, with these two books.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were reasonable. I mean, I had a good career in the advertising
right.
business. And
so that must feel good to know that you're not going to have to worry about paying your bills.
Oh, yeah. No, we don't have to worry about paying our bills.
It's funny. I never ask an author that question, but I felt compelled to see what you would say if I asked. I don't know why.
What I would say to you is that, we're not extravagant people. We're not the sort of people who, you know, wish we could own something we don't own. You know, we're actually, I mean, I feel, I don't know if it sounds smug or something, but we really are quite happy with our lives the way they were before the books, and nothing has really changed. We have essentially the same life.
I'm not sure people don't recognize you on the street. It's not like you're a household name. I mean, you're more, people would more likely recognize your name than your face, wouldn't they?
Sure. I mean, I think probably the only country I might be recognized in these days is Spain, because I've been on the cover of a couple of magazines over there.
And I wonder why. I mean, I wonder what is it that Spain must like these really unusual thrillers. I mean, this is a very unusual book. I anybody who's read Shut Your Eyes Tight will tell you that. I would assume it is a very unusual book, but it's a very good book.
Well, I you know what I've heard too from a lot of people in Spain. They're fascinated in a way by the same thing you are fascinated by in part anyway, and that is the whole Madeline Dave relationship. They seem to be very into that over there, and the notion of a thriller that seems to have real people in it as opposed to, you know, a cardboard cutout detective and, you know, and the women he hangs around with, I think they see Dave and Madeline as real people, and it's an unusual kind of thriller, and it seems to have resonated tremendously over there.
And even the scenes where they're at home, and you can actually picture this farmhouse. It's really, it is a farmhouse, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You can picture this farmhouse, and you can, as you know, he describes walking through it, and you get the picture in your mind, and everything is vivid in your mind, even the way she, even the things she says, and you can imagine how she's saying it, and the look she has on her face. You know, that's important to a reader, and you bring that all to life. I mean, you brought these two characters to life, and we get to see what's happening with them and how it's going to progress. Now, this book, you know, it's full of mysterious elements, things that happen, and the wisecracking detective that he, that's always, I love him. I mean, I love the guy that's still the police officer. What's his name?
You mean Hardwick?
Yeah, Hardwick. I mean, I love the interplay between Hardwick and Gurney.
Oh, yeah.
It's just amazing. I mean, Hardwick's this wisecracking kind of, and he's almost condescending. He's almost makes Dave out to be, you know, too smart.
Mm-hmm.
Too full of himself. You know, he seems to enjoy rubbing that in.
Oh, yes, indeed he does.
And that makes it even more fun. I mean, the sparks fly, you know, and it causes friction, little friction. But
I mean, Hardwick is kind of rough and crude and so forth, but he's also a very smart, perceptive guy.
And it's interesting the difference between Book One, think of a number, the way Dave is in Book One and the way he is in Book Two, there's a difference. He's more, at first you think he's more hardened, but then you realize as the book goes along, the second book I'm saying, he's not as hardened as you think he is into not going back and investigating like he wants to. In the first book, he's much more harsh about it. I mean, it's almost amazing he even does anything in the first book.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right? About that?
I think, you know, that whole point that he's a little different in the second book, I think is very important. And it's something that, you know, I've talked a lot to my editor at Random House about, you know, the idea that we're not just taking these people as like little puppets and moving them from book to book. That, you know, I mean, one of the pluses and minuses, in a way, about Dave and Madeline is that they are kind of like real people. And a lot of the readers who really like the books see them as real people. Well, if you're dealing with real people, then you're not talking about puppets who are the same in every book. They have to develop.
And that's the reason you can't stop writing the series, because you'll have so many people upset if you stop writing the series. I don't even know how you could even think about stopping writing it. I mean, it would be horrifying not to see. I mean, I can't wait to see what Madeline's going to do next. And you probably don't even know everything she's going to do.
Well, you know, they have to incorporate the experiences that the reader has seen them have. So they have Madeline is different in the second book too from the way she is in the first book. And again, there's, you know, the way. And I'm not going to give away the ending, obviously, of Shutter Eyes Tight, but there's a fairly, you know, dramatic ending, and that needs to be reflected in their lives going on into the third book. And I mean, I think people have to be able to believe that these are real people and that this is the way they would react to what happened to them the last time.
And the thing is, I don't know 100% the way Madeline's going to react. And I don't know in the future books what kind of a strain there's going to be on this relationship of theirs. I'm not even sure where it's all going to end. And that's what is even more interesting. I mean, I can see, they love each other, they'll stay together for no matter what happens. I can't say that I know that for sure.
Right.
And you as a writer probably shouldn't be able to tell that either. I mean,
as a matter of fact, you know, I know generally, in a very general sense, what's going to happen in the book. And the thing I know most about is what the criminal is doing. Because, you know, when you write a book about a crime that is uncovered, you're really writing two books. You're writing a book about the criminal activity, and you're writing a book about the slow discovery and revelation of that criminal activity by the detective. Now, when I start the book, I know a lot about what the criminal is doing. I mean, I have to. You can't start writing one of these books if you don't know what the crime is.
Did you know everything that was going to happen in this book before you started writing it?
No. I know basically what the criminal is up to, basically what he's trying to do. And I know some of the ways that will come to light. I know some of the things. I mean, I know the bride is going to be beheaded, right?
Right.
That's like that first little indication of the hidden iceberg of what's really going on. And I think, to me anyway, that's a very exciting kind of moment. You know,
and I can also see in my head that Ed Hatchett is laying there. Just laying there. You can just see it. I mean, you're it's really great the way you picture these things and you make them seem so real. I mean, you would swear this really happened.
See, I know stuff like that, but, you know, how people are going to react in a particular scene or where it's going to take them, that I don't know. So there's a lot of what Dave and Madeline do, particularly interacting with each other, that, in a way, it comes out of them. It seems kind of an odd thing to say, but their behavior is coming out of them. I'm observing it and writing it down. I don't feel like I'm creating their behavior. I feel like I'm watching it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I'm watching an argument, let's say, between Dave and Madeline, and I'm making notes of what they're saying.
Mm-hmm. And then we have those in-between chapters with, in italics, which you'll know what those are later on in the book, but you don't know. I mean, I guess I knew in the beginning what it was, but it's really something you begin to realize why those chapters are there.
Yes, sure.
And we can't give anything away. But
right.
Now, Val Perry, she's the mother.
Correct.
She's another character that I just, you know, whatever you want. I mean, imagine if somebody came to you and said, I want you to do this, and I will give you any amount of money you want.
Right.
And when I think about that, I must admit, immediately I say, wow, financial independence for life. That's pretty tempting. I mean, who could turn that down, you know?
It is a tempting thing, right. I mean, Val Perry is a piece of work, and you know, on the one hand, there's the temptation to get involved in the situation.
But there's also that you know, I can buy off anybody I want kind of arrogance that yes. turns us off, too.
Yes.
Especially if we don't have a lot of money like she does.
Yes, exactly.
But right away I think, wow, he's going to be set for life now. Madeline will never have to complain again. But it turns out, you know, and then you find out these little things about Madeline. I mean, how's that going to affect Madeline? How does she feel about that? You know, and we get to see all that good stuff, all that friction that happens. And, you know, how much is she going to put up with it? Or is she going to put up with this?
Yes.
And there's all kinds of things going on. That's what makes you so great. That's what makes the Ice Princess lady, the other one I was talking about. She's also very good at doing that, at bringing to life a number of different characters.
Well, I have to read her because, you know, listening to you talk about this book, what occurs to me is that I think that you and I probably would very much enjoy the same kinds of books. And
probably.
And the way you talk about books, to me, feels like the way I relate to them also.
Right. Well, some of them are just unforgettable. There are some series, and this, your two books, you know, I'm chomping at the bit waiting for the third one now. Of course, it's going to be a while before I get to read it. But and that's one of the problems today. By the time you get to read the next book in the series, you have to go back and see where you left off. So the reader's kind of like, you know, I have to remember where I left off. Now, with this, it's not so very difficult because you pretty much know where the second book leaves off. I mean, I'm pretty much going to remember where they left off.
Yes.
Because there's not a lot left unresolved as far as the case is concerned.
Right.
So we know where the situation is at the end.
Right.
So I don't think it's going to be. But when you add a lot of different characters to your series like she does, then you have to remember all the different situations. But it's fascinating stuff. It's just fascinating. I mean, I can't wait. Do you have a title for your third book yet?
Let the Devil Sleep.
Ooh, now that's a great title. I like that. And that's another thing that makes Shut Your Eyes Tight so good. I mean, you hear that title, and you think, wow, that sounds really good. I mean, the sound of it makes you want to open the book up and read it. That's a good thing.
Well, we're trying to with the titles of these books, I think what we're going to stick with is if it works, I think we'll stick with the four-word command.
And what was it again?
Well, this is, first one was think of a number, second is shut your eyes tight, and the third is let the devil sleep.
Let the devil sleep, okay. I'm going to forget the title if I don't write it down. I my short-term memory is not what it used to be. But that is, it also, I mean, it brings all these things to your mind. You know, the imagination runs wild, so to speak. But the thing that made think of a number so wonderful is that letter and those numbers. You know, what did all that mean?
Yeah,
and the whole book you're reading, you're saying, I've got to know what's going on in this book.
Yeah,
and when you find out, you're like, wow. And that's what makes the book so good. In addition to Dave and Madeline adding their spice, and I don't remember, is Hardwick in the first book? I can't remember him much.
Yes.
He is, but not as much as the second book.
And he'll be present in the third also. It just seems to me to be a nice, interesting counterpoint to Dave.
I'm not quite sure that I know. I mean, Hardwick doesn't seem to me that he has it all together.
He's he's an angry guy. He's got a lot of repressed anger. He's got authority problems. He's got some hidden stuff. And as a matter of fact, this may be looking ahead, a bit too far. But he may have some serious problems in the third book, and maybe by the time of the fourth book comes around, it's conceivable he might not have a job anymore.
I wonder when you dream up a character like this, and of course when you read certain books and characters just come alive, and sometimes there are certain characters that you just can't get enough of. But did you know from the beginning he was going to be like that, or has it just progressed and you just know it as you're going along?
I know it as I'm going along. One of the ways that I develop a character, or that the character develops, is that I very often start with is a tone of voice. In other words, it's not like I think of what I want a character to say, and then figure out how, what that sounds like. I start with the sound, an attitude in a tone of voice, and that, to me, it is a way of starting to develop a character, because there are certain kinds of things that you say if you speak in a certain tone of voice, you see. And it, to me, the tone of voice starts to create the attitude, and then the character starts to grow.
I love the scene between Dave and Val where she really wants him to do this, and he says, well, why do you need me? There's so many other guys that could handle this, That's that whole scene of she's determined that she's going to get him to do this.
I mean, with Val Perry.
Yeah, and he's determined not to do it. And,
right.
And I think the more that she tries to tempt him, the more he's turned off. It's a very...
Yes, I mean, what he's finally captured by, in a way, at the end of that scene is the notion that there's a video that was taken, at the scene of the crime.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
That really captures him. Oh, wait a minute. I got to see that.
Right. How can I not say?
Yeah. How can I not look at the video?
It's interesting to think, what would you do in that situation? How would you make somebody do what you want them to do? And that, I mean, how it doesn't get much better than that, saying that. Putting that hook out to something you can't resist.
Right.
To me, it would probably a piece of chocolate would do it for me. I'm very susceptible to food, so.
I think me too.
But it's interesting. I mean, all these situations, when I think about all you went through to write this book and all the situations you had to see in your mind as you're writing the book, it just fascinates me. And they both are fascinating books. I just can't wait to see where it all goes, where it all leads to. And everybody that reads the first one is going to feel exactly the same.
Well, in a way, I'm kind of interested in seeing where it all goes, too.
But the thing is, you'll know before we know. So you have this. You can do it. You're going to write this series. And is it the same writing it as the fans? Do you think you feel the same way as the fans? Do you think you feel the same excitement for the characters?
Well, I like being with them, and it excites me when I see them do something new, or it excites me when it occurs to one of the characters to say something that,
And it's got to excite you when Madeline gets mad, and you can really let her rant and do what she wants.
Oh, as a matter of fact, we've had, I've had some discussions with my editor about that. There've been a few scenes with Madeline that had to be tamed down a little bit.
Oh, really? I'd love to see the unedited version of those.
I let her go a little too far.
Now, I can't remember. Does Madeline have any family? Have we met any of her family yet?
Madeline has... all we really know is that she has a sister down in New Jersey.
So are there plans to bring some of her family into this mix?
That's not happening in the third book. It may very well happen in the fourth book.
Do you want it to happen at some point?
I think maybe her sister in New Jersey is going to become a real thing. I'm not sure about anyone else.
Well, hopefully she'll be a real pistol and really, really throw a wrench into everything. Because a lot of times family can do that.
Well, if she appears, she's going to appear for a good reason, and I think, and not just a plot reason, she'll appear for an emotional reason.
And that's the wonderful thing that you do so well. I mean, with characters, every character has to have their own voice, and they can't be any kind of a cardboard character. You've got to flesh them out. We've got to know things about them. We've got to feel like we know this person. It can't just be this standard person, you know, whether it be the donut loving cop or whatever, you know, that we've seen a million times. Dave Gurney is somebody special, somebody different that we've never met before. And, you know, he's somebody we care about, and yet one chapter you love him, the next chapter you're getting angry at him. And his wife feels the same way.
Yes, exactly.
And you know, we're experiencing some of the emotions she is. And then when she gets angry, we're like, you get him, girl, you know. That's how we feel. I mean, and I'm sure everybody that reads this book is going to feel that way. I mean, we feel for her.
Well,
thank goodness she has a book club, you know.
I think the people who end up really liking the book are very into that process, too.
I bet I've surprised you. You never dreamed this interview would be as fun as it has been.
Well, I think it's been a great pleasure, and I really do appreciate not only your interest in it, but obviously the attention you've given it and the care with which you've read it. That's wonderful.
Right.
Thank you.
It's amazing, I can't wait for book three. Maybe you'll send me an early copy.
I think we can do that.
I've often thought, and David Baldacci also has said wonderful things about your first book, especially your first book.
David was very kind.
And David is just one of the really nice guys. If anybody's met him, you know exactly what I mean. He's a sweetheart. I mean, he treats people so well, and he's just such a nice guy. And as successful as he's been, and he's been ultra successful, he still respects his readers, and that's really, you know, where it's at to me. I mean, that means a lot to me, and it means a lot to the fans. You know, they want to see that. And he's one of the funniest guys you'll ever meet. Have you ever met him in person?
No, I haven't.
You need to go to a signing of his. He has the best. He came to our store, I guess it was 2 years ago, hysterically funny for an hour.
Really? Just,
he told jokes. He was funny. He's down to earth. He's got some great stories. He's got one particularly great story about a fan he met in an airport one time that was reading his book. And, you know, they're just, he has a great way to tell a story. So if you ever get a chance, you got to go to one of the signings and meet him. Just listen to him. He just has a wonderful sense of humor. In fact, there's an interview with him on my website.
I'll track that down and listen to it.
Because he's just a wonderful guy. He's so down to earth too. And the man doesn't have to be. He could be the most arrogant person you'd ever want to meet because he's been so successful. But he's not. He's a regular guy, and he's a really nice guy. And it sounds like you are too.
Well, thank you.
I can't wait to let the devil sleep.
That's it.
Now I'm going to wonder. I'm going to lay awake nights wondering what this plot is about. See, that's the whole thing. You want to know what's the plot. And obviously you can't give away too many. It's too early to give away any details.
All I can tell you about that particular book, what it's about, very simply, is an old serial murder case that not only do the police believe they understand completely and have solved, in a sense solved, they haven't caught the guy, but they think they understand the whole rationale for the case. The case, as a matter of fact, has become a kind of a teaching archetype in forensic psychology classes. And, you know, for 10 years, theories have developed about the case, and everybody thinks they understand it perfectly. And Dave gets pulled into it because a young journalist is doing some interviews with the family members of the victims of that serial murder spree.
Oh, and Madeline's going to be mad. I mean, is Madeline going to be mad? You could just...
Well, actually, she's conflicted because...
Well, that's good. That makes her more interesting.
Yeah. In the third book, again, it's hard to talk about this without talking about the ending of the second book, but in the third book, Dave is... shall we say, experiencing the effects of what happened at the end of the second book.
Right.
And he's kind of depressed. And
you know, that shocked me, too. I did not see that coming. That's all I'm going to say.
That ending?
Yeah, not the ending of the revelation, but exactly what happens to Dave, and that's all I can say.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
I didn't see that coming.
In the third book, Madeline is conflicted because Dave is depressed at the beginning of the third book, and it's almost as though she sees the choice as Dave's depression or allowing Dave to, in a way, be helped by his obsession. So when he has an opportunity to get into what seems on the surface to be a very harmless thing, you know, just kind of helping it, giving some advice to a journalist who's working on this project, she kind of encourages him to get, you know, moderately involved. And anyway, the strange things start happening.
Right. We better not go any farther than that, I guess.
Okay.
Much as I would love to, I don't want to spoil it for me. I mean, there needs to be a really not knowing. I hate when you open a book and sometimes the jacket copy gives away too much.
I know, and that is a problem.
And, you know, sometimes you just need to say, you know, you need, and people that come into the store, I always say, think of a number. When I recommend thinking of a number, I said, I don't want to tell you too much about it. Sit down, read it, enjoy it, because you will. You will enjoy it, but I don't want to give anything away, and it would be a crime to give anything away in any of these books. So I don't want somebody to write to me and say, "Oh, don't let him give away too much of the third book. We haven't even read the second book yet." But you know, and I'm sure after people hear this interview, and I hope we can get it on your website. That'd be great. But you really have some major talent, and boy, what I think about those 30 years and what could have been, and now what will.
But here we are, right?
That's right. Is writing as much fun as you thought it would be?
It's totally absorbing, and you know, it's the thing which when I do it, the time passes the quickest. And I think it's because there are very few other things that I can sit down at a computer and work on, and you know, 4 hours pass and I haven't really noticed.
I meant to ask you how your wife reacted to the first book when you first let her read it.
Well, when I wrote the first book, honestly, I didn't think it was going to be published. I wrote the book to see if I could write the book, and because she suggested I take a shot at it.
Oh, come on, it's practically a masterpiece as far as I'm concerned, a thriller masterpiece. Now, I mean, is it going to win a major book award? Probably not, but it might win an Edgar.
Well, I don't think it's going to. The Edgars have been decided, but I believe it's a finalist for the Nero, which is.
Is it really? Well, it's got a good shot at winning. That's for sure.
It's one of the five finalists.
I can't imagine that if you wrote that book, you didn't know you had something special.
I really didn't. It's hard to see that. I mean, you're looking at it from a different direction, and it's hard to see it. So when I gave it to my wife, and then she didn't see any of it until I'd finished it.
Right. Like Dennis Lehane must have felt after he finished Mystic River, which, in my opinion, is a masterpiece.
Well, I gave her the book, and over a period of a couple of days, she read it, and she came back to me, and she said, I really think it's very good, and I think it's good enough that you ought to try to get an agent and, you know, move forward with it, you know.
And you didn't have any trouble publishing it?
I sent out queries to a whole bunch of agents. I went into one of those agent databases and made a list of agents who were interested in mysteries, thrillers, crime mm-hmm. stories, and so forth, and sent out, I don't know, probably about 50 inquiries. And a lot of them just showed no interest, rejected, you know, the idea, you know, the one-page query letter kind of thing. But then I got this... I got a call from Molly Friedrich, who said, send us the book. Send us the manuscript. We'd like to see it. So I sent it to her, and I think 2 days later, she called me, and she said, I haven't quite finished reading it, but I absolutely love it. Don't show it to anybody else.
Isn't that amazing? And having read it and knowing how great it is, I can't imagine every publisher didn't feel that way. It blows my mind that they don't.
Well, they didn't read the book.
Oh, that's why.
They read my query letter.
Well, that explains it, yes.
I didn't really know what I was doing with query letters, so it might not have been a very good query letter.
Now, Craig Johnson, who's a mystery writer, you probably haven't read him. He writes mysteries set in Montana, tells a story about his first book, A Cold Dish. If you ever get to meet Craig Johnson, don't miss the chance. He's one in a million. And you're going to hear more about him because they're going to make a TV series of his mysteries. But he tells a story of actually going to the publisher and having the door. They were just about to shut the door on him, and he threw his manuscript in the door right before the door shut. And funny thing is, the person who read it called him up and said the exact same thing you just said. Don't let anybody else have it. We want this. And you know, you hear those stories, and you know it just amazes you. And yet there's all this talent out there. There's all these good books, and these publishers are not making good decisions. Obviously, Crown made the great decision, but the other ones, you wonder, what were they? Why didn't they read it? They must get. But you see, there's so much with that too. I mean, they get a lot of. I'm sure they get a lot of query letters.
Oh yeah, oh, of course they do.
So how do you know when something's great? It's just really a feeling.
But I don't know. I feel so fortunate with the whole thing.
And what made Molly Friedrich want to read the book is the question.
Well, I don't know. She read it. Her daughter works with her. Lucy Carson also works in the agency. She's Molly's daughter, and she had read it also. Just before Molly was reading it, I think Lucy was a little ahead of her, and I think she went into her mother's office and said, whatever you're working on, stop doing it and read this. So they were both, I think, very enthusiastic about it.
I think anybody who picks up this book, think of a number, the first one, is you're going to know right away it's one in a million. It's like nothing you've ever read before and probably ever will read again.
Well, thank you.
And I mean that very sincerely. We wouldn't be talking right now if I didn't feel that way. But we have to say goodbye, unfortunately. I know we've gone over time as it is, but every minute's been a pleasure.
Okay, my friend. For me, too.
And the book, again, is called Shut Your Eyes Tight. It's out from Crown Publishers in hardcover and all your bookstores. Don't miss it. It's just fantastic. And it's a great book to take to the beach, too. But you won't get any time in the water, I can guarantee you that. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.